Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So I have to start with a little timestamp, if that's okay.
Got it.
Right? So it's Monday, November 2nd, 2015, and I'm here, Josephine Ensign, and I'm here with Dr. Benjamin Danielson, who's the medical director of Odessa Brown Clinic. And we're actually in the administrative offices of Odessa Brown. So thank you again for taking time to do this. And as we've discussed a little bit, this is for the Skid Road Project, mm-hmm. which is seeking to kind of increase an understanding of the complexity of charity healthcare in King County and health, as you can imagine, very widely defined, including social determinants of health. So the first question that I have for you is, what led you to the work that you do? What's your path here?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, I had the luck of doing my medical school studies at the University of Washington and the good fortune of getting to do my residency training in pediatrics at Seattle Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. And through those times, the Odessa Brown Clinic was kind of known as this, you know, important entity in the heart of the central area doing really good pediatric work. So I finished training and worked a couple of years in White Center in West Seattle and really enjoyed that and had a chance to sort of build a clinic from scratch from in that area. And then this opportunity to work at the Odessa Brown Clinic came up, and in 1999 I was, you know, selected to be the medical director. So that's the physical path. I think historically, we grew up in pretty abject poverty and struggled a lot of my younger life to get by, and did a lot of the things that I guess the families that come to our clinic kind of deal with.
Was that in Seattle?
No, that was in Washington, D.C. The East Coast Washington that was named after this Washington, I think. We had interesting times, and my mom just always kept a sort of sense of the need for us three kids to both think very seriously about education as our way to kind of climb out of poverty, and also about if you do climb out, then you have to really be involved in reaching back and helping other people out too.
Right. Sorry about that. Let me turn this off. So your mother obviously was a big influence on you. Any other people that you can think of that were very influential in all of that?
Oh, man. The list would be very long, and they include people that helped me as a young child and have helped me ever since. I'm a big fan of the idea of mentorship and of the need to have people around you who support you and the need to support other people. Just in medical school, they instilled this idea, one of my mentors anyway, that in this profession you are always a student and always a teacher. And I've sort of extended that idea, but the work of being humbled and learning from the things around you and the work of trying to be a teacher in that environment too is really important. So
a whole pyramid of people that were influential.
Definitely, yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. One person that's been influential in this region was a doctor named Abe Bergman. He was a pediatrician who's now retired. He went to high school at Garfield High School and was in his residency or early practice time at Seattle Children's when the idea for this clinic was born back in the late 60s. And he was essentially the doctor who sort of brought Children's Hospital to the table around the idea of starting a clinic like this. I'm not sure that the rest of Children's knew he was bringing them to the table, but he did, and he was, and he recognized both this opportunity and this challenge that was presented to make healthcare relevant to a community that has historically been on the margins of access to services like healthcare.
Right, and I've heard you tell the story a little bit about the history of Odessa Brown, which is fascinating. And the connection with Children's Hospital is also fairly unique.
Yeah.
So you want to speak a little bit to that?
Sure. So it was the late 60s and civil rights era, and Lyndon Johnson, for all his other qualities, signed some really important things into law, including civil rights legislation, Medicare legislation, and little projects like the Model Cities Project, which was a way for the federal government to go into communities and ask those communities around the country, what do you need to reinvigorate your inner cities? Because at the time, there was a recognition that things like I-5 and highways and suburbanization were at that time bleeding a lot of inner cities of their vitality in many ways. And so the Model Cities Project was presented to various communities. And if you look around the country, there's sometimes little rusted stained signs that say Model Cities Project here and there. Not many things survived that project, but our clinic was one of them. And I love the idea that it was really asking a community what it needed, not telling a community what it should do. That meant that a community task force was formed in the late 60s, and then they spent like 2 years trying to figure out what they wanted to do, which I think is great as well. True community process with these very vocal, very powerful voices, yelling, arguing, discussing, negotiating, working it out, sweating it out, bonding, and really thinking about what would be the best thing for this neighborhood. And finally coming to the idea that they wanted a place that promoted employment and entry into the healthcare field, that was local and accessible enough to get to easily, that felt like it reflected a community's values, which was largely African American at the time, that had at its focal point their most cherished resource, which was this community's children. And so that was the idea. It was initially going to be called something mundane and sort of firehousey, like the Garfield Station Neighborhood Clinic.
That does sound a little bit more boring than Odessa Brown.
Boring. Odessa Brown was one of the task force committee members and a very strong vocal person. She had had a lot of tough experiences obtaining health care because of the color of her skin and because of her poverty, especially when she lived in Chicago. She'd be turned away from clinics and ERs, and it enraged her. And on one occasion, she was there trying to get access to care. Her little kids were beside her. She was being told that she could not get care at that facility in Chicago. And she started to boil up. And then she kind of looked at her kids. She took a breath. And she said something to the effect of, I am black and I am poor, but but I will leave this place because I will not let you take away my dignity. And she made a promise to herself and to her kids that they would grow up in a world where they didn't have that experience of being turned away because of the color of their skin. So she brought all this energy to this task force. You know, the classic single mom, hairstylist, community activist prototype. And she had had enough bad experiences in healthcare that she did not talk to people about her health. So she got very sick. She had cancer, got very sick and passed away very quickly. And nobody else on this task force that had been sitting in rooms like this for day after day for 2 years talking about their needs, nobody knew she was sick.
So she just kept that.
She kept it to herself. It was a journey that a black person takes where they don't share, they don't talk about that stuff. And she passed away, and it was a shock, and everyone was really, really surprised. And it was a few months before the clinic doors actually opened for the first time. And so this task force, as one of their last acts as a task force, and maybe first acts as an advisory board to the new clinic, was to rename it the Odessa Brown Children's Clinic.
All right, so they named it in her honor.
Yeah.
So, and where do you, I mean, it's kind of like a rich oral history part of these stories. So, how has that been passed on within Odessa Brown to you?
We keep our history very alive in many ways, and that's partly because we have living history here. We have staff members who've been here almost since the beginning of the clinic. There's one pediatrician here named Ken Feldman, and my joke is that he was in his residency when the Vietnam War broke out, and he enrolled as a conscientious objector, and so as his penance for being a conscientious objector, he was assigned to interrupt his residency studies and come and work at the Odessa Brown Children's Clinic when it first opened up. And the joke is that we've just never told him that the Vietnam War was over.
It's over. So he's
been here ever since. He's an amazing person, the state's witness on child abuse issues, and an incredible encyclopedia of medical wisdom, and a man who's been the pediatrician for two or three generations of families now. So there's that oral history that stays here. And like many great communities and community entities, the oral part is really important. Crystal, who let you in this office, she was a patient here when she was a young child, and she's a grandmother of a patient who comes here, and she's worked here since for 25 or 26 years. Right. There are connections like that that are important. And then there's also been projects like we did. One of the young resident physicians did a project sort of chronicling the history of the clinic around the time I started here in 2000.
So that's, and I noticed it's even kind of front and center on your website. That's
front
that's
and center.
Kind of
we do.
Part of it.
Right. We show people around the clinic and we talk about our programs, but we also talk about our history. And there's a wall that is all women and all great, amazing women who've really stepped up and done incredible work to keep this clinic going or to get it off the ground, including Odessa Brown, and its first medical director, whose name was Blanche Leviso, and a few other people, all women.
Right. So what are some of the highlights for you in your career so far? What have been some of the biggest joys, would you say?
Biggest joys? Sometimes those come in little small packages.
Yeah.
There was a young man who I wasn't so sure was going to really be successful academically in his life, and who has struggled a bit, who I got to know over the years, and then he kind of pulled himself together. I didn't have anything to do with it, and got himself into college and went off to an historically black college in the South. And then he, in his freshman year, he came back. He hadn't quite found a clinic over there yet, so he wanted it just to get a checkup so he could enroll in some intramural sports or something. And he brought me a t-shirt from that college. And there's little things like that that sometimes are just really, really, really moving and important. Every year we have a Juneteenth celebration where we barbecue in the back parking lot here and just all gather as a clinic family and share a moment and talk about Juneteenth and the history of slavery, and share good barbecue. And every one of those years I would count as highlights. We have a lot of great experiences. That's sometimes the days when the snowstorm shuts down the city and I, you know, trudge to work, not a long walk, but trudge to work through the snow and get here and open up the doors, and lo and behold, families find a way to get here, and you know, they care so much about making sure their kids are healthy that they've trudged here as well, and we have a make-do, makeshift clinic, and do the best we can.
Right. So those kind of like seeing the continuity, seeing the effects of the clinic, it sounds like, on the community and vice versa.
Yeah, and celebrating together.
Yeah.
Really important.
Right. So what are some of the biggest challenges for you in your career, would you say?
There are interesting ethical dilemmas, I would say. One of them is the dilemma of maybe any community-oriented entity that is serving marginalized groups of people. And that is the challenge of making sure that your interest in doing your work does not supersede the interest of helping people. And what I can mean by that is, you know, a clinic like ours is kind of a safety net clinic. We serve 80% of the families who come here are on Medicaid. We serve as an adjunct to a healthcare system that's pretty broken. And a lot of the time I'm working to try to make a broken system work better. But limping it along may be more harmful than really allowing it to completely crash so we can rebuild a healthcare system that is done right, that is just and ethically appropriate. So on some level, every day I'm kind of part of the problem, and so is this clinic. So that's an interesting challenge.
Right, and you've also spoken kind of in a similar vein, I would, at least in my perspective, at your talk at University of Washington for the Common Book, the new Jim Crow, about the ethical kind of dilemma you feel in terms of taking care of people, especially young men of color who are going to end up in jail in the prison system.
Yeah. Again, with a system that is so broken and feeds other broken systems that fail people consistently and predictably, in other words, fail like especially young African-American males, it's hard to see yourself feeding into that. And it's hard, I think at that discussion, I said something about maybe our health system is set up to keep young black males just well enough to feed them into a system of enslavement in the prison's systems. And that's a heavy thing. That's a powerful thing to think about. How much are we doing that is just supporting a process that is so harmful to so many people?
So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with those ethical dilemmas?
I think it depends on the day for just about anybody, and just as it is for me. I think that there is value in helping individuals, and we are constantly trying to move what we call upstream and get away from waiting for people to get sick and getting much more toward helping people stay healthy. And we are pushing to be a sort of outside of our own system, our healthcare system, and really promote wellness instead of treat sickness. And that work feels more appropriate. And doing that work can't happen unless you're kind of veiled in the broken system. In our work, you get the opportunity to have a voice and to speak about those problems that you recognize. And through your work, you hopefully are gradually making a difference. It may not be fast enough to help you feel better about what you're doing, but I would venture that anybody's work has that yin and yang to it, has that balance of what you feel good about and what you know is a compromise. And the less you like to compromise, the more you feel the pain of where you're not doing everything you possibly can be doing.
Can you speak a little bit, like an example of some of the upstream measures that you're working on?
Sure. A lot of it's on the behavioral health side, which is kind of more exciting to me in a way, too. We have folks that are trained in something called promoting first relationships, and if a parent allows it, a new parent, picture a young mom trying to figure out how to take care of her newborn and deal with all the other life crises that were there before she had a child, and wanting to do a good job and stressed beyond stress. These providers from our clinics will go to her home and kind of spend time with her while she's parenting, and very importantly, not look for problems,
right.
Not look for labels of dysfunction, but actually look for what she's doing right and really open her eyes to how well she's doing. And maybe even show her in video form how well her child and she are connected. You know, that moment when we were talking, but you knew that your child needed that rattle that it dropped, and you picked it up and you put it, and you weren't even like, you didn't break stride. You just knew exactly what your child needed. That was an amazing moment. And we do things like that. We work with programs that try to help parents understand their brain-building abilities as they're raising their children. I think those things make a big difference. They build resilience. They build a sense of self-efficacy. And they change the paradigm from me as the doctor or the provider having the power and deigning to share it with you in little aliquots as long as you do exactly what I say. And it's a lot more toward you're the most knowledgeable and caring person in your parenting role to your child. I'm here to support you. You tell me what you need. You tell me how you want to do this. You teach me how you do it so well. A lot of the families I work with teach me so much about how to navigate difficult systems, how to make things work out right when there are so many things that could go wrong, how to keep a sense of faith and pride and enthusiasm and optimism for their child's future in a way that I kind of remember my mom doing, which I think is just, that's the kind of energy we need to tap into. We need to understand and challenge and support and spread. That's kind of neat. That's upstream. Other things that are kind of hot topics in medicine these days are how well we integrate medical and mental health services, and we have a pretty robust kind of bit of doing that. We take little aha moments and try to turn them into programs. So one of my great mentors, a woman who's on our wall of fame, I would say, is named Liz Thomas, and she was a nurse practitioner, the very first African-American to graduate from the University of Washington's nurse practitioner program. And when I had finished my sort of official orientation to the job here, she grabbed me by the ear, took me aside, and sort of told me what I really needed to learn and what I really needed to do to do a good job. And she said, you have to get outside of these walls. You cannot just do medicine at the length of your stethoscope. Good care is care that happens as much for the kids who never come into this clinic as it does for the kids who do. And more than that, she also pushed me to think a lot more about treating kids before their kids, pregnancy, and helping mothers have healthy pregnancies so that they have healthy births, so that they have healthy kids, and that sequence is really important. She led me to another funny aha moment that I would tell you if you had time, but...
Yeah, go ahead. It's about a nurse practitioner graduating from University of Washington, so of course I'm interested.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, she was funny, too, because she was in her externship period for her program, and she just showed up at the door of the clinic one day, and Blanche Leviso, the first medical director, was there. And Liz Thomas walked in and said, hey, I'm a nurse practitioner student, and I'd like to do my externship here. And Blanche said, well, we don't really have a setup for that, but, you know, thanks for asking. And Liz said, oh, that's okay. I've done all the paperwork. I've named this place. I'm going to show up Monday and start doing my externship.
Wow.
And so Blanche said, okay. And so she did her 3 or 4 months of externship and came to the end of it and came back into Blanche Leviso's office. And Dr. Leviso said, Liz, it's been great having you here. Good luck with your future. I hope we stay in touch. And Liz said, well, we will stay in touch because I'm going to start working here on Monday. And Blanche said, well, we've never really had nurse practitioners here. You know, haven't really thought about the model. And Liz said, that's okay. I've got it all set up. I've already got a whole cohort of patients who are going to be upset if I don't come back. So Good that was her. Like, yeah, 25 years later, she was raising generations of kids. So that was amazing. But my aha moment is about reproduction and eggs, and about how men make new sperm every day of their lives, essentially from puberty on until they die, how women really are born with all of the eggs that they're going to have. They're born with the full set, and then when you reach menarche, you start having periods and each egg. And it's a very careful and thoughtful approach to how you think about reproduction, especially compared to men. But my aha moment was in realizing that those eggs for that child, half of that child's genetic material was made inside of grandma. The grandma's body was the place where the material for half of the genetic makeup blueprint for a child is born. And that idea that grandma's life experiences, her joys, her energy, her nutrition, her safety, her stress, all of that that she was experiencing was informing her production of the genetic material for a grandchild. And that connection across two generations was a huge aha for me and made me really think about how a clinic like ours needs to honor the elder to youth connection that really is something that helps buffer the stresses and the challenges that any young child might face.
And so did you learn that from Liz, or that was from, like, Stephen Bezruschka, or just from epigenetics kind of research and fitting it with the setting here?
I would like to say that was, like, my own aha of putting together stupid lessons learned. But if I were really honest, I think it was Liz thinking upstream in the life cycle, and a lot of people who care about family and community, who work in areas of kinship and informal parenting, who recognize those things about a grandparent's connection to a grandchild being something special and something important. So more than an aha, I think it was a gradual sort of, oh yeah,
nudge.
I hear you, yeah.
Right. So what does Odessa do in terms of the intergenerational connections?
So far, some of it is mostly around partnering with other organizations who do that well. The Kinship Coalition is a community group that really looks at informal parents, often biologic, but not always, generally not in the foster care system formally, taking up the work of raising. And, you know, I noticed even from my first day working here how often it was a grandparent who was raising children, and how interestingly hard that is to think that you did your work. You kind of like, you got your kid raised
right.
and off, and then a few years later, you're doing it again, and how hard that is.
And you're older.
And what a challenge that is.
Issues.
Yeah, yeah, it's really a challenge. And I don't know, I've had grandparents scared of their evolving teenage grandchild that they're trying to raise and trying to raise right, who's got all kinds of understandable anger brewing under their surface. And I've had grandparents who are really trying to figure out how they want to break cycles that they feel partly a part of. If I didn't do it perfect with my child, how am I going to do it better with this grandchild that I'm raising? So those are really, really important conversations, and those generational connections are significant, sometimes sadly by default and often just by a team effort. The number of moms who talk to me about how much they use their aunts and grandparents and uncles and extended generations to keep bonds going or to be the roof over the head that's closer to school for the child during the weekday, or the place where a kid could at least get a meal during the summertime when school lunches aren't happening. Those kinds of extended generational family connections are things that we need to honor and build from and work from and support.
Right.
That's what we try to do.
And then the other one that I know that you had, I don't know if it's so much community members, but the reading time that
yeah.
you had in the clinic.
Yeah.
Where volunteers would come in and do, and sometimes they were at least of grandparent age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The two quick things I would say about that. One is the reading program is wonderful, and all the evidence shows that either I wasted my time going to medical school, or at least the best way to guarantee that a child will grow up to be healthy is to make sure they get a good education. I think that's what my mom told me like many years ago. So anyway, so we really see literacy and books as health and well-being, and that we have a role to play from the beginning. And books are like, they're part of my assessment of a child's development now. How well they reach for a page or turn it or chew on it, how much their eyes light up when they see a child with another expression in a photograph, how much a parenting moment it is to be sharing a book with a child, and how bonding and connecting that is. So the books have sort of worked their way very smoothly into every part of what we would consider healthcare now. And then there's also this opportunity for what you might think of as a grandparent image to be reconnecting to young people. And so reading to kids in the waiting room while they're waiting for their brother to get his shots done, or in between appointments, is a really important way a community kind of holds together. Or maybe the way somebody from outside the community comes and appreciates this community. And those kinds of outside to inside connections are extremely important as well. And we learned from another program that works with foster kids called Mockingbird, this idea of grandparent as well. They don't say it quite the same way, but their program is built on the idea of hub and spoke, where there's a centralized home that has somebody very experienced in foster care, maybe geographically close to a number of, say, five other foster homes that have foster parents that aren't as experienced. And that hub home is a place of respite where the foster parents can have their kid go there, and they can have a break from the kid if it's really stressful. They can learn about foster parenting techniques. And when you say all of that, that sounds a lot like a grandma and with wisdom and parenting being a resource to a family that's out there in the community. So
you've seen that really help?
Yeah, enormously helpful and so important. And there are so many ways in our society in America where we unfortunately denigrate the role of our elders. Anytime you can build that back into your work, I think you're doing something right.
Right, yeah. So what kinds of things do you do to take care of yourself to prevent burnout?
Burnout is an interesting thing. A lot of medical students ask about burnout, and it's often a topic that gets sort of a lot of play. And I think about life balance the way I think about bicycle balance. If you are sitting still on a bicycle and you try to balance, it's pretty hard and you fall over. So keeping everything exactly balanced in a moment is pretty unlikely. A bicycle in movement, life over time, the balance is very much there. It's in a dynamic state of equilibrium. So I think it's important not to try to examine a moment and know whether or not everything is perfectly balanced or not. But it is important to keep track of the things that are important to you and the people that you love and who love you, and stay connected to those things. I think it's, the risk for me is that the work is so enriching and selfishly fulfilling here that when do you set it aside and do other things?
Right.
That's when you rely on the people who love you to remind you.
To check on you.
Yeah. And even in medical school and before that, you make a point of it to read a book that does not have any biochemistry or anatomy
or
in it.
Epigenetics.
And to take on activities that are either in some other realm of intellectual pursuit or completely non-intellectual and physical. So I survived many new environments when I was a kid by playing basketball. Sounds very trite, but that also became, a piece of keeping me kind of whole, It's sort of the therapy of playing a pickup game, and the sense of community that actually comes with that. It sounds really corny, but those things are important.
Yeah, no, it is. So do you still do that? Do you still play basketball?
Yeah, I'm like many knee surgeries into it, and definitely a broken down body, but still this great group of people that allow me to stumble around on a court on a Sunday, and therein come moments of bonding and connection and discussion and sharing, and they're not in medicine, so it's also I don't know, helpful to be outside of your own environment a bit, too.
Yeah. And so, and what are you reading right now?
I just finished reading Ta-Nehisi Coates' book.
His newest one?
Yeah, Between the World and Me.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. A little bit hard because a lot of it felt really close to home. Not that I would have said the same things, but the experiences were really similar. And so that was very powerful. And now I'm reading like a dumb detective book.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah. J.K. Rowling has a pseudonym she uses, Galbraith or something.
Oh, yeah,
she writes, like this, hard-boiled London detective thing. So yeah. I just started that.
Nice. So are there any things that I haven't asked you about that you you wanted to speak to today at all that you wish I'd asked?
Well, I think it's interesting to try to figure out how to be relevant to your work in a community that is becoming so dispersed, that has become more of a suburban poverty community instead of an urban concentrated poverty community. And that's a really interesting challenge. We've made some choices societally that have really pushed low-income families out of traditional Black communities and have stretched what used to be tighter bonds and connectedness. It's a family now might go very far distances between their church and where they get their health care and where they get their hair done and where they find other forms of reinforcing community. And so the strategies, the idea that the Model Cities Project had so long ago was so based on there's a locality that is central to the work you're going to do. And if you're in the right spot, you can serve the most people. And maybe even if you co-locate, like with another program, a dental clinic or another service entity, then you make it even that much more a convenient magnet to families when they need you. We have to really rethink how we provide services now. King County is a suburban poverty county, and it allows us to not see as much of the poverty that's happening. It makes some of the old strategies that were from the 60s less relevant, and it makes some of the challenges much more difficult. A transportation network is a healthcare solution in many ways now in this county where getting from one place to another is full of barriers. Providing services in the places where people are going to go anyway. A healthcare clinic that's part of a public library, a person from our healthcare program that knows nutrition and goes with a family to their own grocery store and shops with them and helps them shop more effectively, which we do, by the way,
cool.
Is a much more effective model than saying, come here and we'll tell you what to do with your budget.
We'll teach you this in a little classroom.
Yeah, you got to be nimble. And this issue of suburban poverty is a big deal that needs some really big, bold, courageous solutions, strategies, maybe some that might not work well, and maybe some that might be great ideas, maybe some that are aha moments, like the grandmother making the egg makes the grandchild. Maybe it's just understanding a little bit differently about what counts as healthcare. Maybe good childcare is healthcare. Maybe getting some sustainable housing is actually part of healthcare. You see some pieces of that happening in our healthcare system today. There are initiatives like something called a Medicaid waiver that's allowing community groups to count a few other things as reimbursable through the Medicaid system.
Like housing,
help
with finding housing. Yep. Yeah.
So that kind of stuff is cool. But we have to get way more creative, way faster. I think that today the King County executive and the mayor are saying that this metro area is a homelessness disaster area, right?
Yeah, they just announced
that. Did they just make that announcement?
Yes, they did.
I had the heads up about that last night. And that statement is really important. It's not just a sneaky way to get some federal funds pointed in some direction or another.
Or to prepare for the next election.
Or have a media moment for the next election. This is a really serious statement that's being made, and especially when you think of how we're generationally affecting young people who are homeless now, who are really risking being homeless for the rest of their lives. We were homeless when I was young. We were couch surfing. We were borrowing heavily on the grace of our neighbors, and we found a path out of that. I'm worried that the way our system is drifting, there is no path that we are creating intentionally out of that. You think about the 60s, and you think about solving problems, and there was a different kind of intention. There was not a fear of facing things that there is today. I met I knew one of my mentors very well, a man who's a vice president of something at Swedish Hospital named Dr. Vassel. And he came to a reunion for the School of Medicine wherein he was being awarded some community service award. And he stood up there on the stage and he said, "I'm so proud to be from the class of 1972. And the reason he was proud to be of that class is because it was the most diverse medical school class ever. In other words, there's been
nothing
like that since then. It's diminished so significantly. I was one of two black students in my class. And in this year's class of, I think, twice as many medical students, there are two black students. Diversity and cultural humility and improving the lot of people who are marginalized, that happens when you do it intentionally. Waiting for people to just do it out of generosity or out of some sense of enlightenment all of a sudden, that hasn't been there for some other 20 or 30 years, that won't cut it. We have to be intentional, and we have to be creative, and we have to work hard, because the data is pretty challenging right now. The statistics are pretty dire, and this new nature of more spread out poverty, less community bonds, less opportunities for our elders who are debilitated by chronic disease and many other challenges to be there for families when they need them. Those are important, difficult things for us to stand up to and rise up to and find some new solutions for.
So do you have hopes for the future about that? Like, where do you see, like, some hopes that you have for changes?
I have great hope. I think I see in the Black Lives Matter movement an energy and a willingness to be activists
and direct
that was not there in my milquetoast generation. And I think that's great. That reminds me of the 60s. After this, I'm going over to see the El Dia de los Muertos, mm-hmm. at El Centro de la Raza. And anytime you walk in there, you're reminded that people stepped up. They occupied. They talked about oppression and racism, and they stood up to it and made differences. And I see hints of that again in the Black Lives Matter movement, and that's great. I see young people that I watch grow up who have a sense of social justice that I think has been missing for a while, and a sense of that they deserve to have a voice in social justice that is very, very inspiring to me. So I think that's wonderful. I do think that there are chances to reinvigorate the voices of our elders and bring them back to the fore. I kind of hope projects like this actually have that as part of their underlying purpose as well. So all of those things make me very, very optimistic, and I look forward to helping someone else do this work as well.
I think you already are. Yeah. Actually, I know you are. So I just really want to thank you.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that you're doing this.